Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso. We are 1 year into the COVID-19 pandemic that really has affected all of our lives around the world, killed more than 500,000 Americans. One of the sectors that's felt the biggest impacts has been the healthcare workers. And today we are here with four true healthcare heroes who've been on the front lines fighting the COVID-19 pandemic and saving lives at Sharp Grossmont Hospital in La Mesa. And I'm very proud to introduce Dr. Raed Al-Nasser, who is a pulmonary critical physician at Grossmont, and he's going to introduce himself and tell us a little bit about the rest of his team. Welcome to the show, and thank you so much, all of you, for being here.
Thank you, Miriam, giving us the opportunity to be on your show and East County Magazine. We are a group of people here that work at East County. Some of us even live in this county, and we are very proud that we are serving this community. My name is Raed Al-Nasser. I'm a physician, pulmonary critical care. I've been at Grossmont Hospital for about 15 years right now in the intensive care unit and also in outpatient pulmonary practice. I was able to convince my colleagues here and my friends to be on your show because I know them very well, and I know they are excellent healthcare workers and providers that worked very hard during the last year. So let me introduce briefly Dr. Al-Janabi. He's a pulmonary and critical care physician, outstanding physician. He's been working very hard, you know, this year, dealing Thank with COVID-19 patients and other patients. And his work is excellent. And this is a very modest thing that I could say, but you know, a lot of people would testify for that. Melissa Sturk, RN, ICU, SICU nurse. She's also an outstanding nurse. Her compassionate care is felt everywhere in the ICU and in the hospital. The patients love her, and everybody around her also, co-workers, doctors, RT, and everyone else love working with her. Phil Miranda, also he is a wonderful young man, a respiratory therapist. He is a very competent respiratory therapist. He has been working very, very hard during the last year dealing with the sickest patients and taking a very courageous position dealing with these patients who are very sick and highly contagious, and basically putting himself at risk caring for these patients. So we are all proud for being here, and we would love to give our input and provide perspective in how's life during COVID-19 for the patients as well as for healthcare providers.
Thank you, Doctor. So I would like to ask each of you if you could tell us a little bit about what it was like for you on the job during the early days of the pandemic, you know, a year ago, say back in March 2020, or even before, when you first started seeing those first cases of a disease that was very frightening and that we really didn't know very much about. What were some of the biggest challenges that you faced on the job? Vil, let's start with you as the respiratory therapist. You were seeing, obviously, the most critical patients, or many of them.
Yeah, it was pretty difficult. You know, it's already hard enough to deal with, you know, patients that are in, you know, ICU that have a life-threatening condition. And when you have to put all this precaution on top and trying to get dressed and trying to get ready to go into a room and then try to get cleaned coming out of a room, it really you know, delays a lot of the things that we're really wanting to rush to do. And it just made work really difficult as far as patient care. You know, we really want to do the best for these patients. And it almost seemed like we were, you know, at a stop for our own safety, trying to care for them.
Yeah. Did you have even enough personal protective gear in those early days, or were there shortages? I know some hospitals had shortages. Was that a problem here?
We did have a little bit of a shortage, and it was not so much in the ICU. They really made sure that we had what we needed to deal with these patients that were in the intensive care unit and also our emergency room.
Melissa, what about you as an ICU nurse? Tell us what your experience was like.
I can just remember being taught how to don and doff PPE and the fear of, you know, do it correctly and just make sure that you're washing your hands and wiping everything down and, you know, minimize your time and exposure with the patient when these people are really sick. And it's very, very hard to do that. So you had to prioritize your care and you had to go in and do everything you could do and group it all at once. And that meant giving several medications at a time that is going to affect a lot of different organ systems on the body. So you had to be prepared for, you know, what was going to happen and watch that patient because they went down south very fast and there was no way to get in there quickly, like Bill was saying, to rush in there. You had to protect yourself, and having two young children at home, I was very scared. But I knew that it was part of my job as a nurse. And I took that oath when I became a registered nurse, you know, many years ago to help others. And that's what I do on a daily basis when I go to work. And seeing these patients just struggling was very, very hard. There were so many unknowns. I mean, we had no idea what treatment was going to work. It was kind of like we were going in blindly and just doing the best that we could with what we had and what little research we had on it and what was ever going to be effective for them. And some people responded and others didn't. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that's kind of how it's transpired. And we've learned from what people have done on the East Coast and watching New York, where they were hit so hard so early on, and, you know, many different things. And I can remember doing, you know, the donor plasma and all the different medications and just proning and, you know, everything we could think of under the sun for these patients. And unfortunately, some of them succumbed to it. Most of them in the ICU, there's very, very few that came in that were able to leave. And then it's very unfortunate.
For those who say it's like the flu or pneumonia, it really isn't. Can you give us an idea of what the survival rate once you reach a point where you need a ventilator is for COVID versus for other types of diseases that might, or illnesses, you know, that might put you on the ventilator?
Once a patient was intubated, it was almost 99% guaranteed that they were not going to come off. And if they did, if they looked like they were going to have some sort of recovery, it was a tracheostomy. There's two specific patients I can think of. One was a 27-year-old who was trached and actually made it out of the ICU. And the other one was a 54-year-old and he made it out of the ICU. I cannot remember. Those two stand out in my mind. I can't, or the other patients I can't speak to.
Dr. Al-Janabi, can you tell us what your experience was like as a doctor trying to treat these patients with so many unknowns, and also how it affected, you know, you and your own family and your colleagues there?
So, yeah, exactly. The fear is the unknown and the uncertainty, like for how long we will be dealing with this and what is the course of the disease for each patient. I mean, we deal with patients who had, you know, respiratory failure and lung issues all the time. And you were asking about the mortality, and we know, like, roughly someone with severe respiratory failure or lung disease on mechanical ventilator, there is maybe 25%, 30% chance that they might die on the ventilator. But what we have seen with COVID is, you know, these patients, very unpredictable. They decline. They their disease progress very quick, sometimes within hours. Like we would round on the patient and have a plan. And then after a few hours, this patient is gone. And there is nothing that we can put, you know, like we can point as an aggravating factor or why did this happen? So we lost young patients, we elderly patients survived, elderly patient didn't survive, people with a pre-existing condition or people who were completely healthy. It's just hard to predict which one is going to survive and which one is not.
Yeah.
So we were, you know, like as a group of intensivists and within SHARP, we had, you know, meeting with nurses and even with other intensivists within SHARP system. And we went back to like a residency training life. We were, you know, reviewing literature and having weekly discussion and every physician go through a topic through like a therapeutic or medication and which one from a personal experience. Which one is working and which one is not. And, you know, as Melissa said, like we were looking at New York and other states or other countries where like they had a surge and California didn't have the surge yet. And we are just like thirsty waiting for some data or literature or advice from them on how to deal with these patients. But I mean, again, it was very hard. We until now, we are still struggling to figure out which medicine and which therapeutic will work and which is not.
Dr. Al-Nasser, tell us a little bit about your experience. And then also I'd like to, you know, we'll be moving on from there to asking how things evolved as the pandemic progressed, you know, when those hospitals and ICU units started filling up, you know, what was that like at Grossmont Hospital?
Now, I will echo what my colleague here just mentioned. First, you know, we were dealing with something that we're really not familiar with. We're dealing with the unknown. Personally, I've been through different diseases that affected the life of people in a massive way. When I started training, I was exposed to the HIV AIDS pandemic. You know, it was at that time in the early 90s, it was a big deal here in the United States. So I had my exposure to to some sort of really a disease that impacted life of so many. And then, you know, in the 2009, I think 2010, we dealt with the swine flu pandemic, and it was rough and tough, and
yeah, the H1N1
we lost life, but it was still, you know, for a very short period of time. It wasn't like, you know, COVID-19 when, you know, this pandemic pretty much involved lives of every person in the whole world. So the scale was massive. The disease is different. We're trying to kind of look at it in a way that we looked at the flu before, but it is not the flu. The behavior of the disease is different. As Dr. Al-Janabi said, we tried different modalities of treatment and therapeutics. Some of them worked and some of them didn't work, or if they worked, they worked also marginally. So that part that we're dealing with the unknown and we're dealing with something new, it was a little bit, it was actually very scary and stressful. Second, we were always concerned about, ourselves and bringing the disease to our homes and the family. So we were, as Melissa said, we were very obsessive, you know, and how we put our gear and equipment and taking off, washing hands. We were washing hands like so many times during the day that you will have your hands get dry by the end of the day. You walk home, you don't even say hello to your kids or you don't hug them. You just take off your clothes and go to the shower. And so there's so many, you know, practices that we start doing because we were scared and we don't know exactly, you know.
Yeah, we didn't know if you could get it by touching an object that had this on there, by tracking it in with your shoes.
Things,
you know, while even though it was aerial.
Correct. Yeah. And then later on, we learned more and more. And then so we were, you know, it just became part of our routine and daily life. Now, So we had, during the, this past year, we had different times where there were surges. So first, you know, it was the early, I think late March, early April. That was the first, you know, time that we dealt with COVID here in San Diego. And then there was another surge in the summer around July. And but the big surge that we've seen at the end of this year, October, November, December, January. It started, you know, probably after Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas, and all these holidays had contributed probably so much to the really widespread of the.
Oh yeah, I mean, we had a surge. Point in January here, folks, where. You know, the positivity rate coming back on those tests was upwards of 20% or more, which is really frightening. You look around and think one out of five people are testing positive for this thing.
We had a huge surge in these months, and we have to, the hospital has to increase the number of ICU and critical care beds. We were pretty much, you know, all ICU beds were occupied by COVID patients now. You know, you're talking about doubling the numbers of the bed in the hospital. We had rough time, you know, and I think, you know, we have not seen anything like this before.
No, I know some hospitals were putting patients, you know, in tents out in parking lots. They were clearing out gift stores and cafeterias and everything to put COVID patients or even non-COVID patients to
Well, yeah, luckily at Grossmont we have rooms, and but, you know, there were, you know, we used the OBGYN rooms, we the pediatrics room are all shut down. You know, we were just having it for COVID patients. So there was so much of, I mean, the hospital has to do a lot of adjustment for in that period of time. So it was very tough. You know, sometimes, you know, I felt that the doctors, nurses, respiratory therapists, they're really burned out, and there is so much stress on their well-being, mental and psychological. So. But, you know, again, we've been with situations like this before. I think all of them, they're giving the best they can. And the team works, and the team spirit, I say, would work, you know, keeping us all together and supporting each other. So that's how we survived. And hopefully we don't go back to that surge again.
Things should get better.
But, you know, but we cannot predict that for, you know, with certainty yet.
The other thing that had to make this more difficult than dealing with other kinds of things you've dealt with before is that it was so contagious and there was no vaccine. So family was not allowed to be there with a loved one who was frightened. I mean, those of you who worked with them, especially in the ICU there, how did you cope with that? How did you try to, you know, bring comfort to these patients that were in some cases dying alone? To the family members that couldn't be there to see them, how did you cope with that? And it had to take an emotional toll. I know my daughter has been working in an ICU throughout the pandemic, and you know, she said they had a lot of people who quit, who burned out, who just couldn't take it anymore. Literally dealing with people dying all day long for a year. Tell us about that, Melissa.
There's a few things I do personally. I get up and I work out every morning before I go to work. And it really helps me mentally and physically because I've already taken some time for myself during the day, even though it's dark and early, before a 12-hour shift. And I do make that a priority so that I can give the best of myself. And I do my best to keep myself healthy for my patients. And my family, obviously. And it also helps my mental health. There's something about that endorphin rush and sweating and putting everything aside and just taking that time and making yourself a priority when you have to go give so much of yourself for 12 hours and you just don't know what you're going to come into, whether it be chest compressions, whether it be, you know, intubating a patient, you know, but watching a life slip away is never easy because that is somebody's loved one. But you treat that person as if they're your family member. Every patient that I took care of, I always made sure that I gave the family the opportunity to do Zoom. And that was one of the great things that we offered when the families weren't able to be there is,
yeah,
do you want to Zoom? And it was a lot of families did, mm-hmm. but it's very hard to see your loved one like that with intubated, mm-hmm. You know, in some cases, the patient had blood clotting disorders and, you know, their mouth was bloody. They didn't look like themselves. They were puffy. Mm-hmm. They had a lot of fluid on them. And that picture is in their mind forever.
Yeah.
So it was a very personal choice for that family to want to Zoom. Mm-hmm. But it also helped so that they could see, because a lot of these families had so much hope that patient is going to get better and recover, when deep down inside, as a nurse and having watched,
you know,
how COVID has taken so many lives.
We went through this in our own family. We lost an extended family member recently to it. And it was very hard, you know, for the wife to let go and to accept that he'd reached a point where the lungs were too damaged to recover. I do think the Zoom, though, I mean, maybe if there's a silver lining on this, the idea of adding Zoom to not only hospitals, but nursing homes. My mother's in one now after a fall. And actually with Zoom, she was able to talk to relatives out of state, you know, who hadn't even seen her in years and things like that. So I'm hoping that may be one innovation that perhaps will stay, and not just for patients that are dying, but just patients who may be in there for other things, but to be able to stay connected with, you know, family who can't always be there at their side, even if it was safe to do that, you know, distance or expense may keep them from being able to be there. Does anyone else want to weigh in on what this was like, you know, being there when we went through the worst of the surge with the hospitals and the ICU units really filling up to a point where there was probably the county was concerned and the state was concerned that we might exceed that capacity and be having to even triage or turn patients away?
Right. Just to weigh in on one point about, you know, how you adjust to this kind of situation. Okay. You know, we always feel in critical care in particular that the family involvement of patient's care is very essential and very important.
Yes.
So many times that, you know, we needed the family to be there with the patients to help us, you know, taking care of the patient. Because when the patient's in the ICU, they are so confused. Some of them get to a state of delirium. And when they look at the people around them, they don't know who they are. No matter how you try to orient them, it's still very hard. So when they see a familiar face, a family member, they start to feel safe and they start to feel better. And you can start, you know, that process of orienting these patients. So difficult to deal with this situation. And the other part is, you know, from the family's perspective, the anxiety about not able to see their loved ones in the hospital or feel them or, you know, be in touch with them. So I know we made the Zoom and we made the, you know, some sort of way to at least see where they are, but it's not the real life. It is not like, you know, they are there close and touching the patient as well.
Yeah, they can't hold their hands.
So it is as good as possible, but it's not
ideal,
for sure. You know, for me as a practitioner, I was always trying to get in the family, have their report every day. So, you know, I made it a habit for me to call the family member or next of kin and just give them a report. Okay. First day, maybe I will start maybe talking 10, 15 minutes. Second day, maybe 8 minutes. Then as you go and you build that rapport with the family, they're really waiting for your phone call. And doctor, you know, thank you very much. I mean, I could have said so many stories, how I felt more connected with family members, you know, with this pandemic, because it became as a habit now. Mm-hmm. And we have that continuous rapport with the family member. They just, sometimes they wait for your phone call. They know, they ask you a few questions and they are so happy and satisfied.
Yeah, I'd also like to hear about Dr. Al-Janabi too. You can certainly jump in on that one if you want to, but also how the treatments and the therapies have evolved since the early days of the pandemic, and not just for the most critically ill patients, but also any successes in figuring out how to keep people off the ventilator, how to keep them out of the hospital, simple things like, you know, the pulse oximeter at home, for instance, so people would know when it's time to go to the hospital and not wait until they're so critically ill that their survival chances have gone down.
Yeah, so exactly. Initially, we didn't have a lot of knowledge, but then, you know, I would say maybe after a few weeks, because initially we were debating whether someone is struggling to breathe, should be put on mechanical ventilator, but at the same time, we know it's an artificial ventilation. It's a machine. It has its own complication and side effect and can cause lung damage. So initially we were trying to avoid putting people on machines just but at the same time, you don't want them to be on a mask, because the mask or the BiPAP machine also can generate aerosol, which can spread throughout the room and throughout the ICU.
I see.
But then over time, so initially we thought, okay, we should jump in immediately into mechanical ventilator and put everybody on mechanical ventilator. But then you have to deal with shortage in mechanical ventilator, shortage in the ICU room.
Well, so with only a 1 or 2% survival rate, I mean, that's...
Exactly, because it comes in with sedation, with, you know, side effects of medication. Initially, we were using, like, I would say, like a cocktail of IV antibiotics, antibacterial with the antiviral medicine. But then we learned, okay, well, maybe we are overusing antibiotics, antibacterial. We shouldn't do it. Sometimes the less you do, the better for the patient. So, and now we have, you know, non-invasive ventilation. We start using non-invasive ventilation more. And, you know, Vil, the respiratory therapist, he can tell you about his experience with non-invasive ventilation. So it was evolving, you know, over months and weeks. And every few months, we kind of have like a new protocol or update on what are the criteria, which patient should go on non-invasive, which patient should get the antiviral, which patient should get this antibiotic or not. And I think we made a good progress.
So how much has the survival rate improved now from what it was a year ago?
Again, it's hard to tell, because till now we don't have like a proven treatment for COVID.
Just more things to try, though.
Exactly. But I think we developed a lot of experience with non-invasive ventilation, a lot of experience with mechanical ventilation, mm-hmm. and a lot of experience, you know, with using, you know, steroids and antiviral medication with these patients.
I think all over the there is improvement in the outcome, okay, from the beginning till, you know, now. And again, it is not one specific thing. It is not one specific therapeutic, but it's a due to improvement of the care altogether. The therapeutic is part of it. Maybe the steroids helped these patients who had the severe disease and they are very low on oxygen. Mm-hmm. We think that the understanding the process of blood clotting, the thrombosis, it has now we understand it better, you know, putting the patients on anticoagulation, blood thinners, basically, that will help minimizing complications. And in general care, you know, preventing infections, preventing aspiration pneumonia, managing delirium, adequate pain control, the routine things that we all do in the intensive care unit. So a lot of the care improved because of our better understanding of the disease and the behavior of this virus.
Yeah.
And we don't have much therapeutic really level, you know, beyond the steroids, and maybe remdesivir antiviral. And we haven't really, you know, there's not much, you know, that you could say this is effective treatment. Even, you know, multiple trials and studies so far, you know, there is limited.
No magic bullet, unfortunately. Yes,
exactly, there's no magic.
Vil, could you elaborate for us a little bit about this other form of ventilation, the non-mechanical form of ventilation that Dr. Al-Janabi was talking about? How does that work?
So when patients initially came in, of course, you know, worst comes to worst, we just wanted to get them on a ventilator right away. And we noticed that a lot of those patients weren't doing well. But a lot of the patients that we were getting were actually strong enough to withstand what was going on with them. Hmm. And, you know, it, instead of just jumping right into mechanical ventilation, we would use a system called a high flow. So a high flow nasal cannula allows you to give really high flows of oxygen with high flow liter flow.
So this is like the tubes in the nose,
just,
basically,
it's
for oxygen?
Just like a nose. Yeah, mm-hmm. It just goes right on the nose, but except instead of getting like, you know, normally you get like 2 to 5 liters, like very small amounts, we're able to give 50, 60 liters of flow, which is a lot of force. And so we try to keep them on that as much as possible, because what we have found is that the farther we bring them along the journey, a lot of times it wasn't the best outcome. But if they were able to withstand, you know, the minimum, they did a lot better. So mm-hmm. if they didn't,
very good.
You know, work well with the high flow nasal cannula, we would put them on a machine called a BiPAP. And the BiPAP is a complete nose and mouth seal machine that pushes pressure into the lungs and allows them to kind of, you know, get a little bit more volume. And I think a lot of the aspect of using that BiPAP really saved a lot of patients that were not intubated.
Wow. That's fascinating. I hadn't heard anything about that before. So we learn something new every day. I would like to know, particularly from the doctors, if you have had much experience dealing with long haul cases. These are the survivors, the people, you know, who lived through this, but who have been plagued by various debilitating long-term symptoms. Did that surprise you? And for those who aren't familiar with this, can you talk a little bit about those long-term symptoms, and has any progress been made in being able to, you know, I don't know, identify them sooner, maybe to save lives from, say, people who were stroking out right after they got out of the hospital, or to treat any of these long-term symptoms to make it less problematic for people over the long haul?
Right. Yeah. I think, you know, we started to see this long haulers, as we call them now. Okay. And in my outpatient practice, you know, they're coming. And they have a variety of symptoms. Okay? Just don't focus only on the respiratory part, which is really a major one, of course. You know, people who have survived this bad pneumonia end up with lung damage that could be permanent. We don't know for sure, but, you know, we could be a long term. They end up with the scarring, significant scarring in the lungs. They have still symptoms of shortness of breath. They can't walk far. They need oxygen supplementation. Some of them have chronic cough and chest pains. They might become like people with asthma or COPD.
Yeah, brain fog, so, I've heard. People just can't.
Right. So there's that part, you know, the respiratory part that might take long time for recovery. And beside that, you know, there's other, you know, complications. You know, I've started to notice this is very common. And, you know, people who had experienced severe illness, they've been in the ICU and they had rough time, they have neurocognitive problems. And, you know, a lot of them, they have memory issues, fogging in their thoughts, inability to concentrate, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, depression, and a lot of other issues.
Yeah, so it isn't just a matter of surviving, you know, the breathing, the upfront breathing issues.
Right.
What percentage of the people who have COVID, or at least those that you've been treating, doctor, would you say have serious long-haul symptoms?
Well, again, it depends on the severity of the disease and how long they've been in the hospital or an intensive care unit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's pretty big percentage from the patients that I've seen went through the ICU. Okay, I would say for at least 50% of them have some sort of long-term
So 50% of those who were in an ICU, not necessarily 50% of all patients, the ones who maybe never had to go to the hospital, but once you get to the ICU, 50% of them, if they live, are still going to have some sort of long-term
effect, right? And then we're talking about, you know, when we started with COVID, this is about a year right now, some of them still have these symptoms. You know, we don't know if it's going to even stay longer, so they still have to
Well, I guess the good news is that now we have the vaccine rolling out, at least three different vaccines approved now in the United States. As of today, when we're taping this, we've got about 19% of San Diegans who are over 16 have had both vaccines, and others have had at least one. How is that affecting what you are seeing on the job now at Sharp Grossmont Hospital? Are you seeing a lot fewer cases? Is there a lot of relief among the healthcare workers now that that you've had your vaccines? Now, if you have, I don't know, or did any of you choose not to get vaccinated?
No, I would say most of the healthcare providers got the vaccine.
Good.
And there is a relief and comfort that, everybody kind of feel immune to some extent. And then, yes, we have seen, we've been seeing less and less cases of COVID in San Diego area, or at least in Sharp Grossmont. I mean, throughout Sharp, our numbers of COVID patients went significantly down. The curve is trending down day by day.
Very good. Yeah, as of today, the positivity rate was only about 2% on the testing, which is a lot better than that 20% we were seeing just a couple of months ago. But I guess we'll have to see if that lasts, because now as they're reopening more businesses and kids are going back to school, we'll just have to see if we get another surge or if the vaccines will help to head that off. What advice for the two doctors here, what advice would you give to people out there who may not have had the vaccine yet or may have concerns? Is there anybody that, should hesitate to get it or shouldn't get the vaccine? What is your advice?
Let me just start with that point, okay, about the healthcare workers. Okay, the study just came in actually recently, and there are some reports about the dramatic drop in COVID-19 cases among the vaccinated healthcare workers. So the vaccines work. We are, as healthcare workers, are probably the most highly exposed category or high risk category. And basically, we've seen it, so it is obvious that there is so much decline now in cases in COVID-19 among healthcare workers. So the vaccine is work. And we are the force that, facing this disease from the beginning. And I'm sure that we won't take anything that we think that is going to be harmful. So because we believe in science, we believe in the science that was behind this vaccine. How does it work? And we've seen it before in other vaccines. So we know that vaccines prevent disease and save lives. Historically, from the time of Edward Jenner with the first vaccine for smallpox until now, COVID-19 vaccine.
Absolutely, so, and smallpox has been eradicated from the face of the earth because of the smallpox vaccine. Polio is down to just a couple of nations.
There's no way that the healthcare authorities or the government would subject the health workers, the backbone of the backbone of the force fighting this disease, to any way of harm. So we were actually, as Dr. Al-Janabi said, that we were so comfortable that it affected us so much that we felt that, yes, there is a sigh of relief when we got the vaccine.
Yeah.
And even like myself, I was like, I did not get the first vaccine the first day it came on. Maybe 5 days. But it is just, we were just looking for it. So
I just got my second one, and it's a huge sigh of relief, especially as I mentioned, we've had COVID in our family. I'm not a healthcare worker, but I've already had to quarantine, three or four times because of known exposures, including in my own household, where, it's such a worry. Am I going to get this? Am I going to pass this on to somebody else that I might have inadvertently been around? So it is a huge relief.
Vaccine has been, studied well, and they are, and the clinical trials showed excellent efficacy. They've shown excellent safety profile.
Yeah, like 95% efficacy for some of them.
In real life experience, now millions of people in the United States and across the world have been vaccinated. In general, the vaccine is extremely safe. We've seen reports from so many places in the world, many countries, how the vaccine was very effective.
Have you had anybody, I should ask locally, have you had anybody at all that had a, you know, extremely severe reaction? I mean, other than the usual, we know, sore arm and, you know, maybe some aches and pains for a day or so, but anybody have anything to worry about locally, or have they all recovered just fine from whatever short-term side effects they had from the vaccine?
People have adverse effects. When we say the vaccine is safe, it doesn't mean that, you know, you will get a piece of just a shot and a water. Okay, it is. There are adverse effects, but they are generally mild and tolerated, and they usually, you know, resolve within 2 days. Most people have, you know, some sort of pain, maybe some aches, body aches, muscle pain, chills. Feeling very tired, feeling very sleepy. It's a day or two, and most of the people, you know, they go back.
Small price to pay to protect yourself.
Very, very rarely that the vaccine caused a severe allergic reaction. And according to my understanding and my reading, and there was nobody had died from a severe allergic reaction.
Right, even allergic reaction can be treated. Yeah, as one of my friend's doctors told her, allergic reactions we can treat, death from COVID we can't. So, you know, put it in perspective. I have heard that during this pandemic year, I guess if there's a bright spot, it's that flu cases are down. Have you seen that in your practice?
Yes, we hardly have seen any flu cases in the hospital. I mean, me personally, I have seen none. Zero. Maybe Dr. Al Nasser had one patient with the flu in the hospital only. And again, like going back to your question, you know, as a pulmonologist, we always, you know, we deal with patients who have lung disease and their, you know, lung condition is not the best. So we tell them, yes, take vaccine, at least take the flu vaccine. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the hand hygiene, the mask, stay away from the crowd, the social distancing.
Are those things that you think should be here to stay to some degree? Not that we all want to wear masks all the time, but, you know, maybe during flu season or when people are going into a vulnerable situation, going to a doctor's office, for instance, maybe, or on public transit during flu season, maybe it's a good idea.
I think it's a good idea. Mm-hmm. I wish if, like, my patients are listening to this now, like before COVID started, that was my advice to my patients, like, oh, we want to go on a cruise or we want to travel. What should we do? I said, hey, take these small hand sanitizers, take mask with you, be careful at the airport or on a cruise, and hand hygiene all the time and social distancing as much as you can. Stay away from sick people. If you have symptoms, please, like if you have fever or something, you know, tell people around you or don't attend a social event.
Yeah, stay home, stay in your room.
Exactly.
Do you think that we are ever going to see a real end to COVID as we did with something like smallpox? Or do you think it's going to be more like the flu where maybe we'll need annual booster shots, you know, to protect against the new variants or for that matter, you know, the original version, if it turns out the vaccine doesn't last forever?
Yeah, I think it will be like the flu. I don't know. My guessing, it will be like the flu and it will have variants and we'll have like a vaccine for a new variant. I don't know, every year or once in a while, just like the flu vaccine.
And we should note that with these vaccines, they don't just prevent you from getting COVID. Depending on the vaccine, it's anywhere from a 75 to 90% chance that you won't you know, die or catch it, but it also, I understand, prevents you if you do catch it. Let's say you're that 5% that had a Pfizer, Moderna, you know, both vaccines, and you still managed to catch it, that basically nobody has died from it and has been very, or had really serious cases. It becomes more like, if you do get it, it's more like catching a cold. Is that
right?
I mean, your experience, have you had any experience firsthand yet with that?
Right. Yeah. Basically, the vaccine efficacy, it varies between one vaccine and another.
Right.
So in general, all approved vaccines have shown that there is almost 100% efficacy preventing a severe disease that leads to hospitalization and death from COVID-19.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean like, you know, you don't get admitted if you have COVID or some other thing. Okay, you might have a heart attack, you might have a stroke, or you might need it. So, but in relation to COVID-19, you know, being sick from COVID-19 disease, the vaccines were very, very efficacious in preventing severe disease and mortality. So, and that's the most important parameter. If you get a disease, you get mild disease, it's like a rain in the nose and a cold, and you can deal with it in a day or two, and it should be okay. But the most important thing that we emphasize is that vaccines prevent severe disease and saves life.
There you go.
So that's the best news.
I mean, that basically we're ending this first year of pandemic on a very bright spot. That while it's been a very grim year for many, lots of losses, lots of sacrifices, not only those that lost loved ones or are long haulers, but those that lost businesses or, you know, lost incomes, lost schooling. But the bright spot is there's a very bright light at the end of this tunnel. We are moving forward, you know, slowly out of the pandemic. And hopefully in the future, we're not going to be seeing the staggering number of people lost to COVID-19. We are nearly out of time for the show, but I do want to give each of you a chance to give us any closing thoughts that you would like to share with our listeners and viewers, depending if they're listening to this on radio or viewing the video. Vil, let's start with you as the respiratory therapist.
You know, I want everybody to be safe. And, you know, I'm half Filipino and half Mexican, and I've actually had both sides of my family affected, and I've lost 5 people in my family.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
And, you know, it's one of those things that people can carry things within their family, within their friends on their shoulders forever. And if you want to hold a grudge, this isn't the time to do it. You know, it's time for people to get back together. And I think, unfortunately, the age of technology has kind of separated people in a more personal communication aspect. Yeah. And I think people just really need to come together once all of this settles down.
Yeah, I think that's very wise advice. Melissa, as the ICU nurse, what are your closing thoughts on this?
If anything, I could just say, just take care of yourself, you know, eat well, exercise, hand sanitizer, or, you know, just take care of yourself, get enough rest, because your immune system gets weakened when, you know, you haven't taken care of yourself. You haven't given yourself enough rest. You're go, go, go. You're stressed out. So find things to do, do something to take that time for yourself and make yourself a priority, because so many of us don't. And I know that everyone else puts themselves before others, you know, or puts others before themselves. Sorry, I'm very tired. And it's one of those things where you have to make your health a priority. And, you know,
what do you recommend to people who are looking to maybe boost their immunities, especially those who perhaps haven't had their turn yet come up to get the vaccine? Are there dietary things that people can do to help protect themselves?
I don't know anything specific dietary wise, but obviously, you know, get your greens in, do what you can to take care of yourself, because you only get one life. Yeah. And being in ICU is not the way to live it. No. And I can tell you, I love my patients, but I don't want to see them again. And I don't want to see them at all. But it's one of those things where we are there when they are the sickest and in their, you know, their time of need. And I like to see my patients get better and move out. I work in a surgical ICU. So they usually come in for, you know, a surgery, and usually it's been elective, sometimes not, sometimes it's emergent, but, you know, and then they move on and they get better. But watching these COVID patients just deteriorate so fast, and a lot of them have, you know, some comorbidities that could have been prevented and, you know, could have helped them fight this a little more, you know, and that's basically why I why I strive so hard to take care of myself is because I work so hard to take care of others, and I want them to do the same.
Yeah, that's so important.
Yeah.
Dr. Al-Janabi, what are your closing thoughts today on this, coming out of the first year anniversary of the COVID pandemic?
Yeah, I would say it was a long year. It felt like more than a year. I tell people, yes, we treat you in the hospital, but our duty also is to keep you away from the hospital as much as we can. Mm-hmm. So listen to science, listen to healthcare providers. Will work at night. Melissa works during the day. There are people who work 24/7 in the ICU and in the hospital, like minute to minute. They take care of patients. And we lost a lot of people. We were thinking about it, every day. Mm. And I go back home just like Vil. I lost my cousin to COVID, and I had multiple family members also got COVID. And I was scared, like, I'm going to lose them, if it's my wife or my father or my sister. I don't want that to happen to my family. I don't want that to happen to anybody. Please take care of yourself and just, follow simple rules. And hopefully we will get over this.
Thank you.
And thank you. Thank you to the nurses and respiratory therapists. It was a teamwork. Physician mm-hmm. by themselves, they cannot do it. It's responsibility of everybody in the community.
Dr. Al-Nassr, I'm going to let you have the final word tonight on this. And thank you so much for helping us put this together tonight and bringing your team in to share their experiences as frontline healthcare workers fighting the worst pandemic that we have seen in over a century around the world.
Thank you. Thank you, Miriam. So just a final thoughts here about our local community. Okay, we know that the COVID-19 affected the lives of every single person across the world. But here in our community and in the United States, we know that it's COVID-19 disproportionately impacted the racial and ethnic minorities and people who are more vulnerable. And our San Diego County, and particularly East San Diego, is a very diverse community. And we have people from all kind of backgrounds. We have all kind of racial and ethnic minorities living in this. And we are proud of the San Diego County, and particularly our community here in the east side of the county. So, it is indisputable that, COVID-19 affected these minorities disproportionately. And the impact of the disease is horrible in terms of the disease itself, the socioeconomic impact, and how it affected these communities way, way, way more than anybody else.
And the lower income folks that were more apt to be out there, who couldn't just stay home. They were out working the frontline jobs, putting themselves at risk every day, whether they're a grocery store worker or a school teacher,
So these communities need our help. We want to push, for the vaccine in these communities. We understand there is hesitancy more than other, communities, but we want to convince our local community that the vaccine is the way out of this pandemic. Again, the vaccine has been shown it's safe, effective. It's demonstrated that in real life, there's no reason to hesitate. So if you're there in your community, go to the clinic, in your local clinics. There are so many of them, to CVS Pharmacy, I'm not advertising for CVS, but your local pharmacy, or go online. There are organizations and volunteers that will help people to book appointments. They might help you with language, and we know that there is difficulty and digital divide here, and especially people who don't speak English well, but there are people who are ready to help, and we call them the COVID-19 angels. So please, do it because we
they are. And I should mention, we do have links on our website. You can go to eastcountymagazine.org. You can click on our COVID-19 Local Resources Center, and you can find links for where you can sign up for the vaccine, where you can get other healthcare information about it. And also, you can call 211. Maybe those watching or listening here are maybe tech savvy, but maybe you have, you know, someone in the family that isn't, who doesn't have very good English skills. They can call 211, and the county has people there that can assist them in getting those critically important vaccine appointments. So with that, I really want to thank all of you, all four of you, our healthcare heroes. You've been putting your lives on the line to save others for the past year under just the toughest of circumstances. And I think I can speak on behalf of the entire community when I say thank you so much for the sacrifices and the hard work that you've done to try to keep us all safe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, 89.1 FM Descanso. And if you're watching on our website, for watching the video on eastcountymagazine.org.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com. This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine Radio Show. If you would like to be the media, here's your opportunity. We're looking for some more talented volunteers for our East County Magazine radio show. So if you've got radio experience or just a great voice, or if you'd like to get experience writing scripts or special reports for the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 619-698-7617 or send an email to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We're your community media, bringing you news from our region that reflects the public interest, not special interests. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show. A free press is the foundation of our democracy. You can support independent public media for our region by making a donation or a sustaining monthly pledge of any amount at www.knsj.org. We're your community radio station, KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, serving the San Diego border region from the mountains to the sea. That's www.knsj.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.